You're listening to Classical Music here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I'm your host, Matt Jackford. Joining me is a very special guest, composer, conductor, and instrumentalist David Amaran, who will be performing on our very own Mountain Stage on Sunday, July 23rd. The show starts at 7 p.m. at the Culture Center in Charleston. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to be here, and I'm sure looking forward to coming back to Charleston.
Let's start out with your background in music. It's so eclectic. You write orchestral music, like in your score to the film The Manchurian Candidate, but you also have a lot of jazz influence and world music. How did this all come about? How did you learn all these various types of music?
Well, I was brought up on a farm in Feasterville, Pennsylvania, after we moved there from Passer Grill, Florida. And it was a farm that my uncle, my father, my grandfather, and aunt all had. And even though it was rural Pennsylvania during the height of the Depression, there was always music. We had a neighbor who was from Poland, and they would have these tremendous celebrations and get a whole bunch of loudspeakers because you could hear kazatskis and all kind of Polish music. When I used to mow the lawn across the from our farm, I first heard what we now call country music when a group of cowboys supposedly came and played all these great songs, and they had on chaps and spurs and those big Warner Brothers hats, which people thought were cowboy hats. And I was just overwhelmed to hear how beautiful and how accomplished they were. And after the concert, I snuck up, you know, to see if I could meet one of these cowboys. I was just 9 years old. And I heard the one cowboy say, "Angelo, what time's the train go back to South Philadelphia?" And he said, "I don't know, but we better get out of here. So I said, "Boy, they sounded different when they were singing." So I went to mow the lawn the next day, and Wally Freed, who had the station, gas station, said, "How did you like that?" I said, "Well, I was so glad to finally hear some authentic cowboy music, but they didn't sound that way when they were talking to each other." He said, "Well, they're all from South Philadelphia, and they rent the horses for a dollar and bring up the saddles and their instruments and chaps and spurs, which you don't need to play music." And they gave the concert. And I saw, without knowing it, that anybody can be good at something in music and in life if they devote as much time and effort into it as these gentlemen obviously did, coming from, I guess, from South Philadelphia and being singing cowboys. So years later, when I would hear somebody like Yo-Yo Ma, who was not a member of the Bach family, play those Bach unaccompanied cello suites, he was channeling Bach, and I realized that any of us could learn to do anything that touched our heart if we felt we wanted to be part of that. But it would take a lot of effort and study and hard work. And I've seen people who had done that. Then when I would hear the beautiful concert music on the AM radio, this was during the late 30s, you could hear the Philadelphia Orchestra, which is the closest big city to us, the New York Philharmonic, the Metropolitan Opera, and chamber music. And I heard all of that music. And I could hear Count Basie and people like Woody Guthrie when he still was recording at the very end of that part of his life when he came from California and came to New York. And you could hear just about any type of music. My uncle, who's a merchant seaman, my father's brother, had been all over South America and spoke Spanish, and he told me about all these different countries and kinds of music. Then they took me to hear the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I heard Peter and the Wolf with Leopold Stokowski conducting. Just fell in love with that, with Prokofiev's music and with the orchestra. And then he took me to hear Duke Ellington's band at the Earl Theater and explained to me that this was a different music from here, and that we had to respect that. And when he was shipping out in New Orleans, he heard music from all over the world because it was a port town. And since he was a merchant seaman himself, he would hang out with different people. And he himself loved all types of music. So that's a long-winded way of saying that gradually, without planning it, all different kinds of musics that were surrounding us, I was lucky enough to get close to. My other uncle was brought up in Las Vegas, New Mexico, at the turn of the century. And he was brought up in a neighborhood. His dad had a junkyard, and he was in a neighborhood where Native American people all lived. So he was brought up hearing that music and having friends that showed him a lot of what had been here for thousands of years, and used to come to our farm and tell me, talk about that to my sister and I, how we had to respect those who were here before we were, and also try to learn something about their music. Then we sold the farm, and I moved to Washington from a 160-acre farm right into what they called at that time in the 1942, a checkerboard neighborhood. That's because black and white folks or African-American folks and people of the Caucasian persuasion, even though our nation's capital was officially segregated, everybody in the checkerboard neighborhoods were neighbors and all hung out with each other anyway. And I heard music there day and night. So all of these different musics just were some things that sort of became part of my life. And as I began to study and try to learn about one kind of music, I would fall in with people who were interested in other kinds of music. And when I was the first composer in residence with the New York Philharmonic, when Bernstein chose me, 66, 67, he said, never forget all those musics that you play and love and incorporate what touches your heart into what you write. And remember also your job is not just to please yourself, but to add something to the repertoire and to be an ambassador for music, to make other people see the joy of music as a gateway towards excellence in whatever you do.
Right. Right.
And when I was 12 years, I wrote music for Shakespeare in the Park. I only had a handful of instruments. So I had to learn how to write effectively for a small group and also to write music that would fit a play where the actors would hear the same music for 20 performances and mm-hmm. not be able to be so bummed out by hearing something they didn't like.
Right,
it was
right.
Just sort of like background music. They wish that it would wreck their performances. So it was the idea of... So when I worked with Jack Kerouac doing those first ever jazz poetry readings in New York City, I was already tuned into the idea of trying to be an accompanist, just mm-hmm. as you do when you play jazz and the tenor saxophone, somebody's playing the solo. You don't play the flight of the bumblebee and the bombing of Hiroshima at the same time
yeah.
that they're playing. You try to figure out what you should do. And when I wrote my violin concerto, I had to struggle to cut out a lot of the accompaniment when the violin was playing,
yep.
which I wanted to do, but I had to eliminate those hot licks and not try to show how brilliant I might wish I were, but rather to do something that would fit the piece and be harmonious with the soloist. So it's always, each time it's a different challenge and a different
right.
struggle.
Right.
And I really enjoyed those beautiful links that you sent me of your music, because, you know, even hearing it the first time, I could hear a whole lot.
Yeah.
Rather than 64,000 notes blasting out at the same time and wondering, what did the political candidate used to say? Where's the meat? Is there
yes.
a beginning, a middle? Is there a beginning, a middle, an end? Is there anything that you could relate to other than just general noise?
Right. Well, I think I learned a lot from listening to film scores and the clarity that comes with film scores. That generally, there's one, maybe two things going on at one time. And I think, when I listen to your film scores, I got that very lushness to it, especially in the score to The Manchurian Candidate. And that was the original 1962 film, which had Frank Sinatra,
yeah.
Lawrence Harvey. What served as your inspiration for that score?
Well, I was just lucky because I was working with great director John Frankenheimer, who loved Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, Chopin, and Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and blues. He was a very educated guy. And he said, you know, when I make a film, he said, 95% of it is casting. And he said, I'm a terrific visual person, as you know, because he was a master television director that could do something live. And he'd have 92 different shots, and he would brag and show when it was finally in the air. He'd snap his fingers, say, camera three. And sure enough, it would change. And he had the visual sense. And he said, as far as the acting goes, I would get the right people for the right part, give them a basic instruction of what they should do. He said, and then he said, let them go. And he said, that's what you do as a composer. So I want you to write just as you would as if you were writing a symphony or playing a jazz piece or something that you were doing. He said, just remember that the film will tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, this was the quote I loved. He said, it's not just another hack Chinese war movie.
Right.
And I orchestrated it and conducted it and chose the players and chose the jazz players and got the chamber music and classical players and even played in it myself. And I got the best people that I knew, and I put as much heart and effort into it as I did when I was writing my own symphonic music. And I didn't have a ghostwriter or an orchestrator because I'm a composer and I wanted to do it the best that I could. Nobody can stop you from doing what you love to do as well as you can do it and to keep trying to get better and learn more. So it's a good way to live. And also, Matt, if I can dare say to your audience of West Virginia and around the world who listen to the station, it's good for your health to do what you love to do.
Yes.
And it's fun to go out anywhere on the planet and do that. And instead of getting bummed out and saying, oh, it's so hard to travel, it's so hard to be lonely, it's so hard not to have what someone else has, and instead of all that junk that distracts you from the joy of living, just to go out there and put in a good day's work and hopefully make other people feel good. And if you can do that and help your kids to get through school and go to the dentist and learn to say please and thank you and have a family too, then you're living as good a life as any trillionaire could do.
Right.
And it's a wonderful thing. And music itself is such a reward with the people that you meet and the places that you can go.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful thing to pursue. So I always try to encourage people to do that. If they feel that they want to do it so much that they just have to do it, then I say that they should. And when they're told by their career counselors that it's an overcrowded field, there's no market for it, that's the constitutional right of anybody to tell someone else to give up before they get started.
Right.
But it's better to hang out with somebody else. And most important, to remind those naysayers that there's never enough sunsets and never too much beauty.
Right, yeah.
And that's summed up best in the South by the colloquial expression, keep on picking.
right. I like that. If you keep on picking, sometimes you can be selected as the composer in residence of the New York Philharmonic, which you were back in 1966 by none other than Leonard Bernstein, as you mentioned before. I mean, that's really incredible. How did that come about?
That was another miracle in my life. Just like being on mountain stage at the age of 86
right.
as a promising young senior citizen composer. And it was just one of those miraculous things. I had never gone to Tanglewood. I had never studied with Nadia Boulanger, which was what you were supposed to do if you wanted to be a big-time composer. That was the so-called career trajectory. And I always explained to people way back then, I never wanted a career. I hoped maybe someday my music would have a career. Not me, because I was just there for a while and still am, to try to put something out there. But I never thought of that as some kind of a career. That's just something I wanted to do, and hopefully to do what Bernstein told me, to add something to the repertoire. So people said, look, you have to send this out to this and that place. And of course, you send out a package and it would come back unopened. And then you keep sending it. So I had one of those packages that was floating around to different places. And most of the time, nobody, because there's a lot of people. And all I had to do was put a new address on it over the old one and put some scotch tape on it. And I sent it out, and, assuming that I'd probably get it back in a year with nobody paying attention to it. And sure enough, I got a phone call saying that I had been selected. And I thought it was a crank, like a crank call. It was supposed to be a secret that we got that, but I figured it was somebody knew about it, was playing a joke or something. And I went to the Philharmonic. I was there for a year, and it was just an extraordinary experience to be around all those great musicians and to be with Leonard Bernstein. And when he saw that I was appreciative of him, he liked the music he heard of mine, which I didn't know, for Splendor in the Grass. And I had heard some of my other music, and he liked it because it didn't sound like what was supposed to be the flavor of the month, but something that seemed sincere. And he said, I think you could learn a lot here. And then he said, you can go out and encourage other composers and musicians and players and listeners to pay attention to the beautiful music that they could hear every day on the streets of New York if they pay attention. Because, as you know, he loved Latin music and jazz and folk music and singer-songwriters, and appreciated the beauty of everything. And he said, you should also be an ambassador for music and try to bring quality music, not kids' music, not jokes, schlock, stuff that musicians hate to play, but things that we all love, and bring that to younger people and try to be an ambassador for music, which he did. And of course, his education programs were phenomenal. And everything that he did was phenomenal. And then sometimes at the end of a night, he would say, how did you like the concert, David? I remember they were doing a Mahler symphony. I said, oh my gosh, it's just so beautiful. He said, did you hear the cello entrance in bar 16? Or whatever? I said, yes, I sure did. He said, what did you think? I said, it's just gorgeous. He said, no, it wasn't. He said, it was a little off. He said, I was responsible. And then he said, but remember, when you make a mistake, even if no one knows it, that will stay with you forever if you're really sincere, and you won't ever make the same mistake again.
Right.
And he was very supportive of other people. But then he would go through and be very critical of what he did. And I realized, in spite of his fantastic personality and worldwide acclaim, he was really serious about the music and about trying to get it right. And he was so gracious to every person who crossed his path, to every person in the orchestra, to all the people who would come to the green room and talk to him, and to anybody that he met. He was always an ambassador for music, and such a brilliant guy, and also a wonderful composer. We're beginning to realize, now that he's not here, and we, a generation that hasn't gotten to actually see him or know him, they can hear some of that music that he wrote, and it's so terrific. And it's just wonderful to see him getting the recognition as a classical composer that he has always deserved.
Right. We play him a lot on this show here on Classical Music, and he is one of my personal favorite composers, and I always hear all sorts of audience members love the music that he writes. We've talked a lot about your composition career. Let's talk about your performing career. So when you come to Mountain Stage on the July 23rd show, what exactly are you going to be playing, and who's coming along with you?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, since I'm usually open for anything and whatever the situation requires, I try to figure a way to be harmonious as part of that situation, rather than here I come with my entourage, my hairdresser, my career counselor, guru, psychiatrist, dope dealer, and assorted, I like Chuck Berry. He would just show up with a clean suit, his guitar, and play up a storm with ever, whoever, wherever. You have such a great band on your show.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be doing some things where hopefully they'll play with me, or we're going to have a chance to rehearse it. And I believe I'll be doing a wonderful song by Phil Oakes called When I'm Gone. I knew Phil. He was such a beautiful singer-songwriter. I'm doing a Leonard Cohen song. And then, believe it or not, a Woody Guthrie song that could have been written tomorrow or today, or certainly the day before yesterday, called Pastures of Plenty. And this will, interestingly enough, be a month before or 2 months before I go play Farm Aid for the 24th time, where Willie and his musicians celebrate the family farmer of today.
Mm-hmm.
And that this idea of caring about those who feed us and who feed our families and what we feed our families are really, really important. And so I'm doing Pastures of Plenty. And in it, I use an instrument called the hulusai, which is a wonderful Chinese horn that I got when I was in Chengdu, China.
Oh, I've been to Chengdu.
Years ago.
I've been there.
And I heard this magnificent instrument. So I thought, maybe somehow I could use that in a Woody song. Then I'm probably going to do, if there's time, It's a Wonderful World.
Nice.
Because that one, again, I was with Jack Kerouac and Richie Havens, and we were sitting around talking about the summer of love, when that became an official branded fashion statement. Then we heard this song by a guy way over 40, he was, I guess, in the 70s, Louis Armstrong. What a wonderful world. This beautiful, simple song about just celebrating the beauty that surrounds us. And we said, boy, if that could get on AM radio in the summer of love, when someone over 30 wasn't even supposed to be on the planet, maybe it was, is, and always will be a wonderful world. So I love doing that song because it was so simple.
What will you be playing? Will you be playing piano or jazz, French horn?
Yeah,
or?
I'll be playing the piano and also the Chinese horn. And
probably, awesome.
And then the one I know I'm going to do, because I'm always asked to do, is the song that I wrote with Jack Kerouac in 1959 for the film Pull My Daisy, which was, now people can see it on YouTube, but it was something that we did is kind of like a home movie that Jack narrated and for which I composed the music and which he asked me to be in as Mez McGillicuddy, the deranged French hornist. And I'll probably do three of those four because I, in spite of our long-winded conversation or my long-winded part of the conversation, when I'm playing, I always try to end up 30 seconds to a minute earlier than I'm supposed to.
That's
so
good.
I won't go, going overtime is, I always say to kids, they say, well, man, you love to hang out and talk and stay up all night with us. But when you do your shows, you always end up right on time or early. I said, well, when you're doing a program with other people, it's very important to be conscious of starting on time and ending on time or a little early. I said, we can't control American foreign policy, but we can control our own conduct.
Right.
So if you go 1 second over time and step on someone else's time to express themselves, that's as bad as bombing another country, because you can control your own conduct. So I try to do that to act properly. And I'm thrilled to be coming on your show, and I wanted to tell your listeners, I hope that they get a chance to hear some of your classical compositions, as well as that super hip tango version of the NPR theme, which is beautiful. And it's wonderful to see an accomplished composer like yourself be able to be in a position to show people about music, and also get a sense that people who are doing what you're doing also can be in the music field and be creative themselves, and that maybe other state radio stations around the country can get the composers and conductors and guitar pickers and singer-songwriters and African and Latin American and Native American musicians to also be on the radio and share their dedication and their skill and their communicative abilities and their knowledge and their passion for music. That'll make everybody who's listening feel more at home.
Right. Well, that's very nice to say and well said, David. This is composer, conductor, and instrumentalist David Amran, who will be performing on Mountain Stage on Sunday, July 23rd. The show starts at 7 p.m. at the Culture Center in Charleston. David, thank you so much for coming on today's show.
Well, I thank you for being there and for all the folks in West Virginia. Probably most of my contemporaries may no longer be on this side of the planet, but for those who are, or for the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, please come up and say hi. And when I told the people all the places I've been playing are going to be on Mountain Stage, they were all knocked out, because it's amazing how many people around the country listen to your great show, and I'm thrilled to be on it and hope I can make a small contribution.
Well, we're looking forward to having you on there. David, thank you so much.
Okay, great to talk to you, Matt, and thank you for having me.